This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Let's not waste any more of her time. Dr. Helen Fisher is a biological anthropologist, one of the world's leading experts in the science of human attraction. Her books include Why We Love and most recently, Why Him, Why Her? Helen Fisher joins us on the long line. How are you, Doctor?
I'm just fine. How about you?
Very good. And folks, of course, may have seen you most recently, ABC's 2020 devoted a full 1 hour special to your work. So folks may have seen you there.
Isn't that amazing? They even titled it the same title as my book. I was totally thrilled.
You got to love that. That's great. So let's start. We got a lot we want to talk about, but let's start if we can with just a Helen Fisher 101. Just tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up doing the work that you do.
Well, I think I'm probably best known for actually not my newest work because it's so new, but you know, I and my colleagues have put 49 people who were madly in love into a brain scanner to see if we can't find out what happens in the brain when you fall madly in love. And so starting with that, how did I get to there? I don't know. I was a pretty normal teenager. I'm an identical twin, though. And even as a small child, I was very busy. People always ask identical twins, you know, do you like the same food? Do you like the same, have the same friends? Do you have the same cavities in your teeth? And so I was always measuring this nature-nurture controversy, you know, long before I knew that there was an issue of how much your behavior was biological and how much of it was cultural. So when I finally got to graduate school in anthropology, I was enormously interested in sort of why we're all alike, what human nature is. And because I was a teenager, I was probably interested in sex and love. And that's what started it out, you know, just wanting to find out, first of all, why the human female lost her period of heat, why women copulate all month long, whereas a dog and a cat have a period of heat and they don't copulate all month long. And then on into why we form pair bonds. 97% of mammals do not pair up to rear their young, but people do. And it's an unusual reproductive strategy, forming pair bonds to rear our young. And then I looked at divorce in 58 societies to try to come to grips with what I have now come to call the four-year itch, but why it is that after, you know, we make so much effort to fall in love and form a pair bond and build a house and have a family and a community, and then we break up. And I wanted to know if there were any biological undercurrents, underpinnings to that. And I then looked at adultery in 42 societies and trying to figure that one out. And then I started doing my brain scanning. And most recently, I wanted to know why you fall in love with one person rather than another, which is my most recent book. So it's all been sort of along the same lines of sex and love, but from a much broader than the psychological perspective, the anthropology of it. I look at other animals. You know, you learn a lot more about human pair bonding, about monogamy, when you take a look at why this strategy occurs in birds, for example, or in other mammals, and when it doesn't occur, et cetera. So to answer the big questions, you've got to know sort of brain science, you've got to know sociology, you've got to know psychology, you've got to know some cross-cultural data, you've got to know about other animals, you've got to know about a lot of things. So I really spend my time reading at a desk.
Yeah. My guest is Dr. Helen Fisher, biological anthropologist. Her new book is Why Him, Why Her. Your dissertation work on the evolution of human-female sexuality, I'm curious what you learned studying that whole body of work, no pun intended, but what you learned, one or two things that really jumped out at you that may have surprised you?
Well, about the loss of estrus periodicity, well, we are way at the end of the bell-shaped curve here in the fact that we really are able to copulate around the clock, and the issue then becomes why. I mean, what would this be? What would be the purpose of this? I mean, you know, sex is very metabolically expensive. It's very time-consuming. We spend a lot of time at it. There's got to be some pretty good reasons why we can do it around the clock or why we can't do it, why we have some choice over not doing it. I mean, when a female dog is in heat, she doesn't have too many choices. She goes for the sexuality almost under all circumstances, whereas the human female can make these decisions. And then so you talk about the evolution of the brain. So I can't think of one thing, actually, that I learned about loss of estrus. I learned something fascinating when I studied my divorce data.
Yeah.
I looked in 58 cultures through the demographic yearbooks of the United Nations, and as it turns out, if you're going to divorce, and a lot of people don't divorce, but if you're going to divorce around the world, you're most likely to divorce during around the fourth year of marriage. And I've never forgotten when I first looked at that data, I said, oh, my God, first of all, I was disappointed. I thought it would be the seven-year itch, but it's the four-year itch. And then it began to occur to me, oh, my goodness, it takes one man and one woman about a million years ago in our hunting and gathering past, it would take one man and one woman about 4 years to raise one child through infancy. And perhaps we evolved the drive to pair up and stay together at least long enough to raise one child through infancy. And then perhaps a great many individuals in our prehistoric past then broke up and formed a new pair bond with somebody else, thereby creating more genetic variety in their young, thereby having children by more than one partners. And, you know, you'll see a woman or a man today who says, well, you know, I'm no good at love. You know, I've had three wives and I've had a child by each of them, or I've had three wives and I've had children by two of the three. I'm a failure. And from a Darwinian perspective, they're doing something, I'm not, you know, they're doing something that's actually adaptive. They're having children by more than one partner and thereby creating more genetic variety in their young. So,
and more likely then to pass on their genes, I guess is the point.
Yeah, or pass on more variety in their genes. I mean, you know, in my most recent book, I think we've evolved these four different personality styles, and I think they have different quote-unquote reproductive strategies. People who are very expressive of serotonin, what I call the builder, are traditional, conscientious, loyal, orderly, and I suspect that these people create long, very durable marriages and have a lot of children with one partner. And I suspect that another sort of style of thinking and behaving, which I call the explorer type of individual, who's expressive of dopamine, these are more, they're restless, they're novelty-seeking, they're curious, they're creative, they're very individualistic, they're highly sexual, and they're probably more likely to form a pair bond, form a monogamous relationship with one individual, break up after a while, and form a new one with somebody else, therefore creating more genetic variety in their young. So Mother Nature has sort of created several ways that we can pass our DNA into tomorrow, stick with one partner and go through thick and thin and have a lot of children with that individual, or have a series of relationships and create more genetic variety in your young.
We're talking with biological anthropologist Helen Fisher. And her new book is Why Him, Why Her. The phone lines are open if you got a question or a comment, 977-1070. Helen, talk more about the latest book, why you wrote it, where it came from, and what is the message in the book?
Well, what I was doing is, you know, I had written four books on evolution of pair bonding, divorce, adultery, what happens in the brain, et cetera. And I had never tackled that question, why him, why her. Why do you fall in love with one person rather than another? For some reason, it hadn't interested me. I actually had some various chapters in which I covered the basic sociological data on it, but I hadn't been interested in it until Match.com, the internet dating site, came to me 4 years ago, and they said to me, would you meet with us? And I said, well, sure. And they, in the middle of the morning meeting, there was the CEO and 11 of the brass, and they said, why do you fall in love with one person rather than another? And I said, I don't know. Not only do I not know, but nobody else knows either. And they said, well, would you want to start a new dating site with us? Which we did. It's called chemistry.com. There's 5 million Americans on that dating site, and there's 2 million other people in 39 other countries. So my questionnaire now is in 40 countries. And I set out to try to understand whether you are biologically drawn to some people rather than others. You know, people will say, well, we had chemistry, or we didn't have any chemistry. I want to know what that means. Now, there's two parts of personality. There's your character. There's everything you grew up to learn and believe and think and do. And there's your temperament. And we know a lot about your childhood environment and how that pulls you towards certain people. We know that we're drawn to people from the same religious background and the same socioeconomic background and same general level of intelligence and same general level of good looks. But nobody's really ever studied temperament. Do curious people go for curious people? Do stubborn people go for stubborn people, et cetera? So I set out to find out as much as I could about variations in human temperament and then see who's drawn to whom. And basically, I mean, you asked me what the bottom line is. The bottom line is that I think we've evolved four very broad personality styles. And then on chemistry.com, I looked among 28,000 people to see who was drawn chemically to whom and found some of nature's patterns.
Absolutely fascinating. Helen Fisher, biological anthropologist, is the scientific advisor to chemistry.com, and her latest book is Why Him, Why Her? Why do we fall in love with one person rather than another? So tell us about when you looked at these patterns with thousands and thousands of people falling in love,
yeah,
and you studied this, these patterns started to emerge, and like a good scientist, that's what you look for. You look for these patterns, and then tell us about the patterns that emerged and what you learned from them.
Okay. Well, first of all, I've got to tell you about the four personality styles. First of all, we're all a combination of all of them. And basically, I'm studying four basic chemical systems, dopamine, serotonin, testosterone, and estrogen. But I lump oxytocin with the estrogen. If you are a person who's very expressive of the dopamine system, I would call that kind of person the explorer. I just made up the term. Those people tend to be novelty-seeking, risk-taking, curious, creative, often very generous, irreverent, quite liberal, very flexible-minded, often quite charismatic. The people who are very expressive of serotonin, I call the builder. They're traditional. They're calm. They're social. They're cautious but not fearful. They are very exacting, orderly, punctilious, conscientious, loyal. A good example would be Colin Powell or Tiger Woods. A good example, I think, of the explorer would be Barack Obama or even Angelina Jolie. Very different kinds of people, but temperament is the same. The third is the people who are very expressive of testosterone. I call them the director. It's a lousy term. Plato called them the rational. That was better. They're analytical. They're logical. They are tough-minded, direct, decisive, often rude. They're so direct. Very good at what scientists call rule-based systems. They're good at math and mechanics and engineering. They can often be very musical because that's very structural. They're self-contained. John McCain was a perfect example, a fighter pilot who was very good at spatial relations and who was proud of saying, "I'm not Mr. Congeniality." The fourth is the what I call the negotiator. I think Bill Clinton's a good example, and I think Oprah Winfrey would be a good example. These people, they see the big picture. They're holistic thinkers, contextual thinkers. They're imaginative. They're intuitive. They're very good verbal skills. I mean, the whole world knows that Bill Clinton can't stop talking.
Yeah.
They're very good people skills. You know, he says, "I feel your pain." He probably means that. They're emotionally expressive. So anyway, I created a questionnaire. There's 56 questions in it. And it's in the book, Why Him, Why Her, and you take the questionnaire and you see to what degree you express all four of these systems. Now, for example, I'm largely dopamine and estrogen, largely the explorer and the negotiator. And then on the dating site, chemistry.com, I watched who is drawn to go out with whom. I don't have data yet on whether they fall in love with them and marry them. But actually, I've got data from another avenue to see that how these relationships work out long-term. But long and short of it is, I took a study of 28,000 people. I could have taken 128,000 people, but that was the last study I did. And I found that the explorer type, the high dopamine, the risk-taking, novelty-seeking, curious, creative, adventurous, and it can be adventurous in the reading books as opposed to jumping off mountains. You know,
yeah,
to,
yeah.
You know, they go for people like themselves. They are naturally drawn to people who will jump up and go to the movies with them, jump up and go to the theater, ride their bikes to a different part of town, go to an airport and go to a new city, etc. The builder type, who are very traditional, cautious, conventional, I think those are the people in the red states, actually, the high serotonin type. They go for people like themselves. They want somebody who's going to be loyal, conscientious, devoted to home and family, flipping the parties at flipping the hamburgers at the neighborhood party, just building network and connection. So in those two cases, likes go for likes. Birds of a feather flock together. But opposites attract if you are high on the testosterone and the estrogen. Somebody like Bill Clinton, who's very expressive of estrogen, has gone for Hillary Clinton, who is very high on the testosterone. I think quite the reverse would be somebody like Sully Sullenberger, who landed his plane in the Hudson River very high on testosterone. I mean, you know, you got to have spatial skills to land a plane in the Hudson River. He was also very self-contained. I mean, the whole world was calling him a hero, and all he could say is, I'm doing my job, and with no expression whatsoever. And his wife was, you know, crying in the background and thanking everybody for their, you know, for their love, et cetera. And so Laurie was very much of the negotiator type. And I think what they're doing, I think that the negotiator and the director, the high testosterone and the high estrogen types, are pooling very different resources. The sort of indecisive estrogen type, it needs the decisiveness of the high testosterone. The high testosterone, who's so sort of clinically analytical and not very good people skills, sort of needs the compassion and the people skills of the high estrogen type. So what I think we're seeing in Mother Nature is traditional goes for traditional. What they're doing is they are capitalizing on some very strong child-rearing traits. The director, the testosterone and the estrogen types are pooling very different resources to raise their babies. And, of course, I was stuck when I wrote the book on why would the explorer type go, you know, be drawn to another explorer? I mean, who's going to take care of the baby while you're climbing Mount Everest, you know? But I think what they might be doing, going back to our early conversation, is having a series of relationships and creating more genetic variety in their young. But what I got out of all this was that these different kinds of people express intimacy differently, regard different kinds of things as intimate behavior, court differently, build different kinds of relationships, will have different kinds of strengths in their marriages and different kinds of weaknesses. And for me, it has enormously opened my eyes to how to treat problems in marriage, how to reach intimacy with a partner who's quite different from you. A host of things have come up now that I've come to more clearly understand human nature.
Biological anthropologist Helen Fisher is our guest, and her new book is Why Him, Why Her? Why We Fall in Love with One Person Rather Than Another. Helen, can you stay with us for one more segment?
Sure.
Terrific. We're going to take a quick break here at the bottom of the hour for local news and weather. And when we get back, let's talk a little bit about some of the research you've been involved in regarding antidepressants and how those can affect our relationships.
Wonderful.
That coming up in just a few minutes on Charlottesville Right Now. Let's rejoin our conversation with Dr. Helen Fisher, biological anthropologist, one of the world's leading experts on the science of human attraction. Her books include Why We Love and most recently, Why Him, Why Her? Finding Real Love by Understanding Your Personality Type. Helen, I was thinking during the break as I was just looking at the book and my own background in anthropology, do you think people have come to really underestimate the degree to which tens of thousands of years of biological programming as, an offshoot primate species really still affects us?
I'm wondering whether it might even be the reverse. I think that in the 1950s and all during much of the 20th century, people believed that we were sort of a blank sheet of paper, that we popped out of the womb without any heritage, and that it's really actually since the 1960s when we began to study, Jane Goodall began to study chimpanzees, and other people started to study baboons, and we began to get into some of the genetics behind diseases, that we've come to begin to realize more and more that that there is biology to our behavior. You know, people will always say things like, well, you know, she's got a stubborn streak, or, oh, I was born that way. They'll say these things, but I don't even know if they know what they're, you know what they're really saying. But long and short is that I think as we're knowing more about biology, I think we may even be becoming more aware of how much of our behavior is biological. Now, how about all these drugs for antidepressants? I mean, people who take them know that they become calmer or they become, more agitated or all you got to do is, swallow a few pills and you know that there's chemistry to behavior and even chemistry to thought processes. In fact, there's new data that that shows that certain temperament types vote in certain patterns. And, in fact, I found that in my book, Why Him, Why Her? I talk about You know, people who are very expressive of serotonin tend to be more conservative. People who are expressive of dopamine tend to be more liberal. I can see it in the cities. On chemistry.com, the dating site, I have many more high dopamine types in the big cities, and big cities are much more liberal. And people, of course, who are energetic and novelty-seeking will go to the big cities, and, of course, they're bringing certain chemical profiles with them when they go, and along with those chemical profiles, certain attitudes. So I'm thinking that we're learning to accept more and more that there is biology to behavior.
We're talking with biological anthropologist Helen Fisher. You mentioned antidepressants, and I want to talk about that for a few minutes. And I want to preface this by saying I don't want this to discredit the degree to which I know antidepressants have helped some people, because they have. But we also know that antidepressants and the really sort of arguably runaway use of antidepressants, even now among children, causes increased risk of suicide, weight gain, adults can destroy your libido. Tell us about some of the research that you've been involved in, some of the most recent research on antidepressants, and what you're learning about some of the devastating effects they can have on relationships.
Well, this is the work of myself and Andy Thompson, who's a psychiatrist in Charlottesville. So,
and he will be on this program. We couldn't get him today, but he will join us.
Yeah, that's just great. But I want to start out by saying how important it is what you first said when you said that, you know, we're not trying to tell people not to take these drugs. There's all kinds of people who have chemical imbalances who need these drugs to get out of bed, to make good relationships, to sustain their relationships, et cetera, et cetera. We're not talking about them. But Andy Thompson and I wrote an academic paper published by MIT Press in which the very last line of the paper was a quote from a Harvard psychiatrist who said that about 75% of the people in the United States, and probably everywhere, a lot of other places too, who are on particularly SSRIs, serotonin-boosting antidepressants like Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, etc., don't really need them. They took them long ago because they were doing poorly in school, or they were going through a divorce, or they were having some other crisis. And then, after the crisis was over, they stayed on them. And this is what concerns me. And I won't speak for Andy, but I think it probably would concern him too. But the point is, and what made me come to this was that, you know, I studied the brain in love. And when you've fallen madly in love with somebody, the first thing that happens in the brain is that there's a big a rush of dopamine activity. And that dopamine activity gives you the focus, the elation, the motivation to win life's greatest prize, this person. Even the feelings of despair. So long and short is we now know that the dopamine system in the brain becomes escalated when you feel intense romantic love. Okay, so somebody's taking an SSRI, some antidepressant that boosts serotonin. All of the textbooks say that when you drive up serotonin, you are driving down dopamine. They've got a negative correlation. So I began to think about this. Now, wait a minute. So if you're driving up serotonin and you're reducing dopamine, that means that when you take these antidepressants, you could jeopardize your ability to fall in love or stay in love. And indeed, Andy and I have now written this academic article, and I get an email from somebody once a week. I mean, I got one a couple of weeks ago from somebody who said, you know, you might be right. He said, I had a girlfriend, and I was madly in love with her. We'd been going out for 7 months, and suddenly I was not doing well in school. I started taking an antidepressant that boosted serotonin, and not only did I lose my sex drive, which we know that happens, great deal of data on that, but I also fell out of love with her, so I broke up with her. And then I was off on the antidepressant about 10 months. I finally got off of it. And sure enough, not only did my sex drive came back, but my intense romantic love for this woman came back. So I went into a florist and I bought as many roses as I could carry in my arms. And I went over to her house and tapped on her front door and said, you know, I think I made a terrible mistake. I think it was the drugs. Would you take me back? And she did. And over I get these kinds of stories where they get on an antidepressant for some other kind of reason, and stay on the antidepressant and don't have a date for 5 years, have no desire to meet anybody, no longer feel attached to their wife, start going out with other people, et cetera, et cetera. And what Andy and I are really trying to say is that these brain systems are connected. I think we've evolved three distinctly different brain systems for mating and reproduction. One is a sex drive, the second one is romantic love, and the third is attachment, a sense of calm and security you can feel with a long-term partner. And these three brain systems are operate in all kinds of subtle ways. And if you begin to tamper with the sex drive and drive up serotonin, as you do when you take these antidepressants, there's every reason to think that you could be jeopardizing your ability to fall in love, to stay in love, or to feel deep attachment to a partner.
Well, Helen, I want to tell you anecdotally, when I was started promoting that you were going to come on the show and started letting people know, I got emails from people here in the area saying, you know, my wife or my husband went on antidepressant and ruined my marriage. They, you know, my marriage fell apart. They stopped loving me. They stopped caring about the marriage, stopped caring about me. And, you know, they blame the antidepressant.
Yes. Well, they are, I mean, we don't, you know, we've got to do the scientific studies, but all of the data points to that. All of it does. I'm just astonished. You know, what really amazed me is that I have tried with Andy to write a letter to Lancet, Science, and Nature, the three of the top journals in the world, and point out these correlations. And from all three journals, I got back the statement saying, this is not of general interest. Now,
over
100 million prescriptions for antidepressants are written in the United States annually. Some people say as much as 170 million. And these drugs have gone generic. They're international. I mean, what is a world without love?
Fascinating. And I wonder if it's because it got something to do with the pharmaceutical industry, which makes, you know, an unbelievable fortune on those things.
Yeah. And once again, back to your original statement, I'm not suggesting that people shouldn't take these. If they are in crisis, they need all kinds of things. But the number of people who are staying on them is what the problem is. And then they wonder why their marriage is falling apart, or why they don't fall in love, why they can't get a date, and they don't know they're taking medications that are so dramatically altering profoundly basic brain systems for love.
We're talking with biological anthropologist Dr. Helen Fisher. Her new book is Why Him, Why Her, and John has been waiting patiently online, too. John, you're on with Helen Fisher. You go right ahead.
Helen, you're trying to establish a scientific foundation for a lot of this stuff and drawing heavily on evolutionary principles to do it, and it seems to me that you can't do that unless you've come up with a scientifically tight definition of love. What is your definition of, you know, being in love?
Okay, great. I wrote a whole book on this, so it's not like I've overlooked it. I've looked at the last 40 years of psychological studies, not only in the United States but all over the world. I actually read a lot of poetry too, but and a lot of novels and myths and legends. But long and short is that when you take a look around the world at scientific definitions of romantic love, you find that there's a core list of traits that are associated with romantic love. The first thing that happens when you fall in love with somebody is somebody takes on what I call special meaning. As one man said to me, he said, the world had a new center, and that center was Marianne. The person becomes the center of your world. Then you focus on them. That's probably the high dopamine. You know, everything that the street they live on is different from every other street. The car they drive is different from every other car in the parking lot. Everything about them is special and meaningful, and you focus on it. Before I put the people, these people who are madly in love, into the brain scanner, I asked them, what do you not like about your sweetheart? I asked a lot of other questions, too. And they could list what they did not like about their sweetheart, but then they focused on what they did. Other basic traits are intense energy. You can walk all night, talk till dawn. Real optimism, even in facing real obstacles. Mood swings into despair when you don't get an email or a call, or they call you by the wrong name or something. The willingness to die for the other person. Sexual possessiveness. You know, if you're casually sleeping with somebody, you don't really care if they I'll sleep with somebody else, but when you're in love, you become very sexually possessive, which probably is contributes to our worldwide crimes of passion. But the three basic traits of romantic love are an intense craving for emotional union. You want to have sex with them, but what you really want is emotional union. Intense motivation what you'll do when you're in love to win somebody is staggering. So craving, goal-oriented motivation, and probably the most profound is obsessive thinking. You cannot stop thinking about this person. You go to bed thinking about them. You wake up in the morning thinking about them. You got somebody camping in your head. And so when I looked at all of those various traits, that constellation of traits, I began to, looking at those traits, I came to the hypothesis that if I looked in the brain, I may find indications of activity in the dopamine system associated with the focus, with the energy, with the elation, with the motivation, in the norepinephrine system, because that would give the pounding heart, the sweaty palms, the feeling of nervousness around the person, and low levels of serotonin associated with the obsessive thinking. So there's many chemicals involved. I've only found some of them. It's going to be a whole profile, but long and short of it is when you look through the academic literature, you can find this constellation of personality traits associated with romantic love. And then what I did is I looked in a lot of other societies. For example, in China, I don't know if I've got time. I'll give you a four.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Well, thank you. For example, in China, 18th century China, there's a poem by a guy called Wan Chen, and it's called The Bamboo Mat. And basically, what this, you'll see what happens. I said in the beginning that you focus on something about a person, and everything about that person you just focus on. So here's an example. It's only four lines. It goes like this. I cannot bear to put away the bamboo sleeping mat. The night I brought you home, I watched you roll it out. This guy became hooked on this sleeping mat because the woman had touched it, had used it. It's not unlike us focusing on somebody's car in a parking lot or their wine glass after the dinner party's over. And when you go to around world literature, I mean, the Romeo and Juliet legend is, or story, there's an equivalent in Japan, there's an equivalent in China, there's an equivalent in ancient in ancient Arabia. You see the same constellation of traits in world poetry, myths, legends around the world.
And your point, John, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. It was a great question. Got a line open at 977-1070. We're talking with biological anthropologist Dr. Helen Fisher. And your point, of course, is that this shared biology that we share, you can see patterns. You see patterns culturally, but you can also see those biological patterns underlying it as well when you start looking at the brain chemistry involved in love.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, for example, in a lot of cultures, they've had arranged marriages. And now how does this work with romantic love? You know, well, in India, they say first we marry, then we fall in love. And they expect their parents to find the perfect boy. And then they meet four or five times, and he's handsome enough, and they like him enough. And then they go through these very very ornate marriage ceremonies that go on for days. And, of course, all of the excitement during the marriage ceremony, excitement, novelty, drives up dopamine in the brain. And sure enough, they often fall in love during that marriage ceremony. So the marriage ceremony has evolved to sort of trigger this brain system for romantic love. It's quite remarkable. Whereas in China, they have this, traditionally, not now, tradition of marrying somebody, and that has been arranged, and since early childhood, and sure enough, they almost never work. There's almost no romantic love in these marriages. They've know the person too well. There's no novelty. There's no excitement. It doesn't trigger the brain system for romantic love. So you can have marriage patterns that, just like you say, Coy, are culturally derived, but they are overlays on a biological system that, in one way or another, comes out.
Why would we evolve, do you think, to have that romantic love and have that emotional attachment that goes tandem with the draw for the sexual union?
That's a wonderful question. I think the sex drive evolved to get you out there looking for a whole range of partners. I think romantic love evolved to enable you to focus your mating energy on just one at a time. And I think the third brain system of attachment evolved to enable you to tolerate this person, to stay with this person at least long enough to raise a child together as a team. So I think these three different brain systems, sex drive, romantic love, and attachment, all sort of work together to help us rear our young. Now, they don't always work together, and that's the problem. You can feel deep feelings of attachment for a long-term partner while you feel intense romantic love for somebody else, while you feel the sex drive, while you're driving along in a car and look at a magazine. So, you know, we're in a pickle. We've got these very powerful brain systems. They emerge from, by the way, I mean, these romantic love, the basic brain systems involved come from way below the cortex. These are not thinking areas. These are not even limbic emotion areas. These are areas associated with drive. It's a drive. We have a drive to love. We're driven to find love. I think it can be the drive to love can be stronger than the drive to live. I mean, people kill for love. They live for love. They sing for love. They die for love. It's a very powerful human drive that evolved millions of years ago to start the mating process with a very particular individual.
Biological anthropologist Helen Fisher, her new book is Why Him, Why Her? Why We Love the Person We Do and Not Another. Helen, I've really enjoyed it, and it's a fun book, not only fascinating, but it's a lot of fun, and I would urge everyone to check it out. And thank you so much for being with us.
And same. Thank you.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.